All right. Welcome, one and all. This is the Everything is Okay podcast. My name is Brad Stair, coming to you from my little closet studio in my house. We have such a good episode for you today. Undoubtedly, if you've listened to us for more than 5 seconds, you've probably heard the music of O Jeremiah. O Jeremiah is a band that we are good friends with. It is composed of Jeremiah Strickland and his lovely wife, Erin Strickland. They are based out of Athens, Georgia. And if you listen to the end of every episode, which I hope that you do, you probably have heard that I like to focus on some friends of ours and feature their music so that their music is getting out there to other people because, in our opinion, you deserve to hear it. So with that in mind, David, Megs, and I had an opportunity to sit down with Jeremiah and to talk about his career in music, how he got into it, how he grinds through it. I don't know how much you guys know about the music business, but the thing about the music business is it's tough. It's really tough. And it's a hard grind to do as a career. So we wanted to talk about that. We wanted to talk about what they do to be able to make this their livelihood. So I hope that you really enjoy it because Jeremiah is a great guy. He's so nice. If you've ever been to one of his shows, you know that they're super personable. And as you'll hear in this recording, that's by design. So I hope that you enjoy this conversation. And we have about two more episodes that we're going to bring you after this one, both of which being with some friends of ours that are musicians. And the final episode of this season is going to be a treat. We have caught up with our good buddy, Zach Ramey, that we played music with in high school. And if you want to know what music we made, it's our intro song. So I am looking so forward to sharing that episode with you. But before that, we have this episode with Jeremiah Strickland, and we also have another episode with James Price discussing his music as well. So hope you enjoy what's coming down the pike, and that you enjoy this episode with Jeremiah Strickland.
I swore I'd make this town famous. Instead, I'm just a tourist with old emotions. A stranger in the world where I came from. I go by a different name. They don't call me either one. With time behind the wheel, it all goes a little too fast.
I'm a big fan of Round 2. And this is
round two.
Is round two with Jeremiah Strickland of O Jeremiah. Jeremiah, how are you doing, man?
I'm so good. I've seen both of you in two different states for several times now, and it's so weird seeing you in a tiny chat window and catching up with you at the same time. This is just surreal to me.
I know.
It is nice.
Brad, you went to the clean shaved head. And Dave, you burly beard, like you both look so different now. It's so pleasant for me. I look exactly the same.
Yeah, you definitely have your look. You have your look. Yeah. It's part of your brand. That's fine. It's good.
Well, I think it's more of the Lord's brand because when I was 17, it was very clear to me that I had no other option. When I try to grow my hair out, I look like a Batman villain, and it's terrible for everyone.
Not the cute villain. You look like Penguin.
I look
saying.
Like Voldemort wearing a Halloween costume. That's like my vibe, like a crappy disguise. So I got the West Nile virus whenever Erin and I first started dating, and she knew me as the bald guy. And then because I was super sick with West Nile, I couldn't shave my head and it started growing back. And I remember her being like, so are you, like when you get better, are you going to like keep the hair? Because it's like she was like trying to nicely tell me, hey, the first thing we need to do when you get better is like fix that. So
that is, that's awesome.
I've looked, and the other thing that's interesting about being bald at 17 and bald all the way to 29 is that all my pictures look the same. Like just because I see a picture of myself, it does not tell me what era it's in. But all the thing that's happened is I just get more lines in my face and my clothes get a little bit nicer. Like that's the only difference in me now between then and 17.
You're like stylistically, I'm definitely moving in the right direction.
I'm Yeah, for sure. Like, I'm getting better fashion sense, but that's it. Like, I'm losing the Hurley t-shirts, and I'm getting more up on the, you know, stuff that my mom would approve of, I guess.
That's perfect. Nice. That's perfect. So, not Abercrombie and Fitch, because Brad and I definitely, I remember us, like, talking about some of the, like, I don't know, like, the posters they would have up. My mom, like, wouldn't let me go into the store in high school. Did y'all have this experience? Because there may be nakedness. Are y'all following this?
Okay, cool. I know what you're talking
about. Yeah, Brad, scrap it. Scrap this. This is bad podcasting. But some people listening to this podcast are going to know what I'm going to talk, you know what I'm talking about. And, yeah.
My parents were pretty liberal in what we watched. For some reason, the first movie I remember watching with my family is American Pie. I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't think that they cared. They were just like, "Eh, you, I mean, you know, it'll either affect you or it won't. I don't want to be in charge of that." So, and I remember, like, for some reason, I remember Christina Aguilera's Dirty video. Do you remember that? Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. I remember.
I like how Brad said that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. But I remember. Yeah. Like, there was, like, a group of people over, and that video came on because we used to watch VH1, and, like, I grew up loving music videos, and it was just, like, a running joke in my family that, oh, Christina Aguilera's on, we have to watch it, and we would all watch that crazy, creepy video together. My parents just didn't care. It was awesome.
That's great. So, one more thing on losing my hair. So, first of all, I'm just apparently trying to be you.
No.
I have your look.
Right? As long as I did it first, I don't care. You know?
That's right. You did it first. I'll give you all the credit.
Yeah.
But my personality is one. I've always been like this. Like, if I get into something, I do not stop studying it for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And I go all out. So, like, for instance, when I get into a band, I don't buy a album. I buy all their albums.
Sure.
All at once. Right? So now I'm into shaving my head. So now I'm learning into how to do that.
Yeah.
Well, then I come across, have you seen this Omni Shaver thing?
So I'm setting my ways on shaving the head because I've been around the block, dude. Like, I'm 12 years into this now. So here's my dive into it. I had a teacher once. The first time it happened, I was 16, and my friend who was female touched me on my bald spot, and she said, "Do you feel that? It only gets worse. Like, it's over." And then I had a teacher that was bald, and he pointed it out, and he said, "You're young to be going bald that quick. Have you ever heard of coochie cream?" And I said, "Ooh. Coochie cream?" And he said, "Yeah, you go to an adult store and you buy coochie cream, and it has, like, a naked woman on it." And what he didn't tell me was it was just cream conditioner. He just wanted me to go to the adult store and get it from there.
Oh my gosh.
But what I did, I instead of doing that, I legitimately just ordered it offline and felt really queasy about it. Like, when it came in, it was in, like, a hot pink bottle, and it was, like, all the things were, like, dirty on. It was just really strange. But and then I tried the head blade, which is basically a Tonka truck over your head. Yeah. Very dangerous. I did damage with that thing. But now I just do Dollar Shave Club. I do the $5 a month, and I do cream conditioner. That's my move.
Nice.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
All right, so we've gone 9 minutes on balding. I have one thing to kind of point out with what you're talking about. So you're talking about self-esteem issues.
Sure.
You shave your head. How old were you the first time?
16? I was 17.
17 years old. You're in drama. So that was one of your kind of artistic outlets. How do you think that high school experience kind of led you down a road to songwriting?
So my dad was the person that called them. I have a very interesting relationship with my parents when it comes to creativity and, like, pursuing this. But my dad was the first person that pointed out, because I grew up in bands. Like, I was 11 the first time that I, like, fell in love with music. And then in the eighth grade, I started a band with my best friend, Jimmy, and we started a band called Idiot Box. And it was essentially a Blink-182 cover band, but I loved it. And we played shows, and it was awesome. Like, we would get, like, 200 kids in a sweaty room and play pop punk songs. Like, that was every Friday night for us. But nice. It never felt like something that I desired. It was fun. It was like, it was, how do I describe it? It was something that I needed, but it wasn't something that I thought was my future. It was a really fun way to spend my Friday nights, and I loved getting to play it, and I never pictured my life without it. But then I got cast as the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz. and we had 11 sold out shows or something. And to me, that felt like a big deal at the time. And I think there's only like 100 seats in there, so it's not that big a deal. But the drama teacher's daughter flew in from New York to see the play. And after our first performance, the New York daughter came backstage and said, "I need to see the guy that played the Scarecrow." And I raised my hand and she looked at me and she said, "You surpassed any high school performance I've ever seen." And that was the first time I'd ever been like, "Oh, I am a performer." I didn't even know that. Mm. And she said, "You need to consider this for your life in some way." And ever since then, I distinctly remember feeling an authority on stage, like a sense of belonging. Because, you know, the older I get, I'll be 30 in January. And the thing that I'm finally coming to terms with is I'm never not going to feel like a fraud in what I do. Because I feel like a fraud almost all the time at everything. But when I'm on stage, it's the one time I can remove myself from that mental state, I think. And that day, whenever I played the Scarecrow, it was the first time I was like, "Oh, I don't have to make excuses for the way that I am because this is enough," you know?
That's awesome. Yeah. Man, I had a guitar player I played with at this local church on Sunday mornings in Hattiesburg. And he pulled me aside and he was like, "I think music saved my life," is what he said to me. And I was like, "Really?" And he was like, "Yeah, it's interesting when I'm playing, when I'm in the zone, it's very meditative. It's almost therapy for me because I'm not thinking about tomorrow. I'm not thinking about yesterday. I'm just one with my instrument and one with the music, one with the people around me." And I thought that was really eye-opening because that's something that I hadn't thought about as a musician at all, you know, explicitly. But you're performing as Scarecrow, like, you are realizing, wow, like, I'm not dwelling on my inadequacies as a person right now.
Yeah.
Which seems pretty amazing.
So the next year I did Daddy Warbucks. And from there on out, I was bald. We can add more to the 9 minutes of baldness if we want to, or I can skip to the next part. So the next thing was I got cast as Buddy Holly in the Buddy Holly Story. And nice. it was a weird thing because they didn't have a Buddy Holly. They were 3 weeks away from the show. In my memory, I may be remembering this wrong, but they were 3 weeks away from the show and they didn't have a Buddy Holly. They had the Maria, they had the Big Bopper, they had everyone else but Buddy Holly. And someone said, "Hey, there's the lead singer of this band. You should see if he'd be interested. I think he's a drama kid." And I go, and I can't tell you how that play was an era for me. It was playing music on stage for an audience in character, but it wasn't just playing the songs. It was being able to interact with the crowd. Like, we and the crowd were one thing. And that's important to me because I wonder how much people would show up to a show if they knew how big of a role they actually had in the performance. You know, it's not just, "Hey, support your local band." If you show up to the show, you're a part of it. And whenever I had Buddy Holly, and that was, we're playing at the Sanger Theater, it was intoxicating. And I was in love with that feeling. And I've been chasing it ever since that. So the drama side of things and the music side of things have always kind of like mixed for me. And then that led eventually to me like wanting to write scripts and make weird music videos, because our music videos aren't music videos. They're more like plays than anything else. And that's, it all kind of like, art is, it's all this one big hodgepodge of things to me. There's no, all the lines are blurred and it all just kind of explodes into one big thing to me.
That actually, you know, it's interesting that you say interacting with the crowd, because the first time I ever got to see you and meet you was when you were here. You came here to, I think, Guthrie, Oklahoma, at a coffee shop. And I hadn't met you yet. And it was myself and my wife and my sister-in-law, who has since become like your number one fan.
Oh, she's the bomb.
Yeah. I mean, she's going to be super excited to hear that you're on this. And, the thing I remember the most is you opened up first, and as soon as you guys started playing, everyone in that crowd sat down And I had never seen that happen before.
That's
Everybody
wild.
Just sat. Do you remember that?
I don't even remember what show you're talking about.
It was at the Hoboken Coffee Shop.
Oh my gosh.
Guthrie.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. With Corey Kilgannon. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And everybody just sat down and got really, really quiet. And I kind of looked around. I think at one point it was just myself and Megan that was standing up. And we're kind of like, what is, okay.
Yeah, that is
we
probably.
We totally stood out like a sore thumb.
Well, so that is probably the most folk thing that I've ever heard. You know, at rock shows, it's just like, dude, everyone took their shirts off. But at a folk show, they're like, we sat down and drank our tea and no one said anything.
Right. It was. Everybody had their like little coffee and just sat down. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I play better when I feel like if I would have been athletic, I think I would have sucked at practice, but killed it at the game because mm-hmm. There's a part in my brain that kicks on the moment someone's watching, the moment someone is like, okay, what are you going to do now? There's a part of me that just like will not wake up until that situation occurs. It happens in my writing. It happens all the, like when I picture myself doing this in front of someone, it changes everything. I will know exactly when a lyric needs to be changed the first time I sing it in front of someone because my brain is like, you're embarrassed that you're saying this in front of them right now. You need to change this the second you get a chance. And the crowd, they don't even have to do anything. You feel it in you. It's a weird sensation.
That's interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. Okay, so here was the main thing. So I got the great fortune of meeting you through David. You know, we've played you on this
podcast. What's up, guys? I'm still
quite
here.
A few times. and then we got to meet in person and all of that, and then we fell in love and
got married.
That's right.
Got matching haircuts.
That's right.
Watched American Pie together.
Ooh, that would be fun.
That would be weird. I wonder how that movie ages. Really. Probably not well.
Poorly.
All the lines from the
Your
movie.
Your boys are in it, though. Do what? Blink-182's in it.
No, they are in it. That's good memory, man. That's good memory.
Hey, man.
They don't age well either, though.
They don't. Although I did see Tom DeLonge in September, and it was pretty good. Just want to throw it out there.
Yeah. We're gonna start a drinking game on Everything Is Okay podcast for how many times like you drink if Blink-182 comes up because my gosh, it comes up a lot. Adding Jeremiah to the mix though, I know
dude,
it's gonna
we're
just
all
double
hammered
it.
If that's
we're
the drinking getting, game.
We all getting drunk tonight.
Oh man, but so I kind of realized like you are. Basically doing what I would have always dreamed to do as a career, right? Because I mean, I played all through college, I guess. And then basically as soon as college was over, that part of my life almost ended abruptly in a way. And so you're flat out doing, I think, what I would just love to do on a daily basis, right? But I'm not nearly as talented. So,
well, let me ask you this. Yeah. Why didn't you?
Okay, so I mean, it's going to sound like a bunch of excuses, right? So I moved away. Of course, I moved to LA, but when you move to LA, if you're not like...
Lower Alabama?
Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And if you move out there, you know, if you don't like completely stand out, you know, you're going to get lost in the shuffle. And I just stopped for a while. For whatever reason, and then I just never got back into it.
Sure.
But what it's interesting is that I find myself now, it's been 10 years, and I actually find myself now like almost longing to get back just to the playing side of it and getting back to how I learned how to play, which was listening to records and trying to play with records.
Yeah, that's the way I can't think of a more euphoric place to be.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, so for me, like I learned how to play drums on Three Dog Night and Guess Who records because that's what my dad had.
Amazing.
There you go. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And he would tell me that he used to know that I was getting better because he could recognize the song that I was actually playing after a while.
Yeah.
With it. So that was always cool. But anyway, I mean, obviously with the way the music business I mean, it's changed a lot. It's, and all of that. And it's a, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's got to be a grind.
It's yeah, that's almost all it is. When yeah. when someone tells me, hey, because I have a lot of these coffees, because I'll have coffee with anybody if they want to talk about it. Honestly, like, I love talking about this stuff. I don't get to talk about it a lot lately because I'm kind of aging out of the dudes my age that are like thinking about doing it. Cause now mm-hmm. dudes my age are like having kids, you know? And, it's like just, they're entering a different phase of their life. So I feel like I'm in like the senior group of this. So I don't have these conversations as much anymore, but I would always, probably the best advice I ever got whenever I asked my mentor, hey, I'm thinking about pursuing this, what would you say? And he said, there's nothing I can say that will sway you or dissuade you. If you want it enough, there's nothing I can't stop you. And he said, because it's awful. And it is, and he's right. Like, in so many ways, it's terrible. But it in so many more ways, it's exactly what you picture. Like, I have zero fun talking about the good stuff. I don't want to talk to you about how great this one show was because like everyone was singing and like Aaron and I were locked in. That's boring to talk about because it's exactly what you're picturing. It's awesome. What I love to talk to you about is the time a guy came off the street and showed me dirty pictures on his phone. And then it turned out I went to high school with his nephew. That's what I love to talk about. So that's the stuff that makes me fall in love with this every day, because everything sucks a little bit. It's just what do you want it to look like when it sucks? Because this is the only job I've ever had where at its worst, it's better than any job I've ever had. And that's why I keep doing it, you know,
because what other jobs have you had?
So I was a theater tech for 8 years, I think. I was a theater tech and I got my hand ripped off, or I got most of my hand taken off in the rope pulleys. And then, it was brutal. And it was for a ballet company and it was all these girls and no one knew how to help me because our boss like hired, well, it was a long story short. We were sheep without a shepherd and my hand got caught because no one knew what they were doing. And all these beautiful ballet dancers were around me being like, is he going to die? Is he going to die? Is he going to, cause no one knew how to help me. And then I just left and I had a guitar jury cause I was a classical guitar major in college. And then 3 days later I had a guitar jury and I walked in with my hand and I said, I can't do this. And I showed them my hand and they all gave me A's. So, so, nice. So I did that. I worked for my dad a lot growing up. I was I worked in the fine arts building at Jones Junior College because I went to a junior college, not to brag. And I got so the whole reason
sure
I started
if you've
this.
Heard of it.
Yeah, not sure if you've heard of it, but the job that got me started doing this, I worked for a clothing company, and they fired me 3 days before Christmas. And it hurt my feelings so much. I said, I'm never putting any time into a job that's not music again. And I on a date with Aaron, I got fired. And then a month later, I started O Jeremiah. So that's how kind of how it all started.
Jeez.
That's mildly romantic. I'm into it.
Yeah. And it's also a lot of the going back to what you said, it's like the romantic comedy after the credits roll, because it's like, I'm not taking a job ever again. And then you realize like, oh wow, like this makes no money. Like I got to figure something else out. So like once the fog of the dream wore off, it was like, okay, practically how the heck do we do this? Right. And the ups and downs in our career, like things have fluctuated, but the deciding factor in everything that we do is how do we keep this going as long as we can? Because at some point, we're not going to be able to do this anymore. And every decision we make is how do we make this last as long as possible? So whenever it's like, should we tour to this city or should we tour with a band or whatever, it's every answer is found by will we last long if we keep doing this? And that's how we make every decision.
Well, I had actually heard, I'd watched a documentary of, I think it was the Avett Brothers. It wasn't a documentary. It was a podcast that they were on with the armchair with Dax Shepard.
That's our favorite.
Yeah, and they were on there with him, and they were talking about every time they ever made a decision to add a band member. And there was always one of the brothers that typically was driving that decision.
Yeah.
He was always saying, hey, we need to add drums or a touring drummer or whatever. And they would always have to weigh the options of, well, that means that per show we're going to get less per person, but we will be able to go to exponentially different places to play.
Right.
Right. So they were always having to weigh that decision as well.
Mm. We did.
So is there a, oh, sorry.
No. Ask me. I have a feeling you're about to ask me the question I was preemptively answering. You can go ahead.
Oh, well, maybe. We'll see. with that, do you guys like set, do you have like a minimum like number of dates you want
to? Yeah. So this is legitimately what I was about to answer. So
nice.
The first tour we ever did, we booked. So I got fired. I don't care anything. I'm just going to be a musician. I don't even care about anything. I booked a tour from Mississippi to New York City. That was the first tour that I ever booked. But I did not know how to book a tour. So I just hired a band and I said, we're just going to do it. No questions. I'm your leader. And I booked New York City. And then the next night we were in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I don't think I told anyone until it was the time to make the drive. And keep in mind, Aaron and I were like falling in love at this point. Like it was an early tour. It was me and Aaron in the front seat and this band in the back. And Aaron is like falling in love with me and also falling in hate with me because like I've put her on the world's worst tour. And then when we got back, we learned that we lost $3,000 on the tour. And then the next one we booked, we toured from Mississippi to San Francisco. I think that's what it was. Yeah, because we drove through Salinas Valley because we were all reading East of Eden. That's the most pretentious sentence I've ever said. But we drove that way and we lost even more money. And one day we went from Taos, New Mexico to Phoenix, Arizona. And after Phoenix, we were in LA and we had two flat tires in 24 hours. And it's shocking how, to insult to injury, when we went to get one of the tires fixed, we passed into California and California law said that we had the wrong size tire on our van. So we had to replace every tire. So we lost $800 in labor and tires and stuff. It's mind blowing. So now for us, Aaron and I don't hire bands unless we know it's going to be like, hey, we got it. Like you got to get a band. This is going to be a big one, but we would rather play a smaller room and know that there's no risk involved because when you play with a full band, it's a ton of fun. But if you're playing to no one, it's heart-wrenching. Like that's the kind of stuff that kills you. That makes you want to stop is when you're playing on a Monday night in, you know, Des Moines and no one's there. You're like, why are we doing this? And then you start to second guess it. And then you like start self-loathing. That's what kills you.
Yeah.
It's not the fact that like you can't book shows or anything. It's legitimately you give up because it makes more sense to give up. And when we tour just the two of us, we have no reason to give up because we make money. And that's what our whole goal is to make this make sense for us. So we will book a show if it hits the, because we don't have management, anything. This is Aaron and I having conversations via marriage. Hey, this is what my needs are. This is what we need to do for this to be worth it. And if it doesn't hit all the marks, we don't take the show. And we just stay between our means. And sometimes we get surprised like, hey, this was a huge win. And because it's so much less risk, whenever it's a loss, it doesn't kill us. But when it's a band and it kills us, it really does damage.
Mm-hmm. Mm. It's so heartbreaking too, to think that the model that we have right now in music for up and coming artists kind of puts y'all in a corner and says, guess what? You can't afford a band.
Yeah.
You can't unless you have financial backing or, yeah, that's basically it. Or you're 20 years old and you don't have to pay for anything. You're all in the van and you're still losing money. Like when you think about, I mean, surely the bands that you and I listened to, the three of us listened to growing up, unless they were on like Tooth and Nail or whatever, some big label, I don't know how they were doing it. Like,
well, honestly, it's shown me because that we've had to adjust to this model. Because when we started with a band, the thing that I kept seeing is the music industry is surprisingly small. So you start running into the same bands and you start like getting put on bills with bands you played with before and like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know you were coming through tonight or whatever. But the thing that I noticed is every time one of my favorite bands broke up, it's because they couldn't make touring work. And you only have to see that so many times before you're like, okay, we don't need to make that mistake. And because of that one decision, we've kind of modeled what we want our career to be. So we're not trying to get on a big label. We're not trying to play big festivals. We're trying to play small rooms where we can really connect to the audience. And that makes us less sexy to a manager or an agent or whatever. But the music industry is in this weird spot where no one knows what works right now. So they'll throw a ton of money at something, and then when it doesn't work immediately, they rip the rug out from under it. And we just don't want to get our hearts broken that way. We want to, you know, we're playing the long game. We're not trying to get famous. We're not trying to be the biggest band in the world. We love this work, and we just want to do it however we can. And as much as we love playing with a band, that's whenever it gets really risky for us.
No, so this
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to throw out, this is an industry question. I think a lot of our listeners would be interested to know. And Brad, I know that you've had some experience with this as well. Have y'all tried to, so your music is obviously, I think it's transferable across many age groups. It's clean. It's very catchy. It's very poppy. Have you tried fishing it out to movies, to TV? Have you got in that world or tried to put your foot in that world?
Yeah. So it's funny you bring that up. We have emailed every person in the music industry. I'm never not working on this stuff. Like if there is some A&R person from some random label, they have an email in their inbox from me at some point, because I'm always trying to move the ball forward. And we have gone to Nashville to write songs specifically for movies. And we've almost gotten into a major, commercial and then a major TV show. We were like really close. And the closer I get to landing one of those things, and they told us, they were like, hey, you're like one of the last three. If you get this, it's going to be like $100,000. And when you tell me that, and then I don't get it, I get really hungry to get it. And the thing is that to do that, you have to sell yourself in a way that is disgusting. Like for me, the reason I fell in love with music is for the words and for the depth and for the uniqueness of it. And all they're telling you to do is, hey, write the shallowest song you can think of. And that's what we want. And I just, the closer I get to that, it gets in my head. I can't make anything worth listening to. So Aaron and I are in the spot where it's like, hey, let's don't keep knocking on people's doors. Let's just make the thing we want to make, and our people will be into it or they won't. And that's what needs to be our driving force. Make the thing you want to exist in the world, and you won't be resentful when it doesn't get you anywhere because you made the thing you wanted to see. And I don't want to see O. Jeremiah make shallow commercial music. If it gets into a commercial, that would be amazing, but I want it to be a song that I like. Because,
oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Because whenever I would write those songs for commercials, I'd be like, I hate this. I hope it works. Which is a weird, awkward spot to be in.
Yeah. So you're saying that you had the producer of the commercial actually tell you what they wanted you to write in this example?
Yeah. So it's called a brief, and it's legitimately says, we have this commercial. I mean, to be like super specific, it's like, man pulls through drive-thru. There are three kids in the back. They're all yelling. He seems upset. But the woman hands him the bag with the golden arches. She smiles. And then the happy, bubbly song about sunshine plays on the way out. And that's the song they need. So it's like they describe to you a hypothetical commercial or a real commercial, and they're like, we want it to feel like this. Like one of them was, we want it to feel like... oh my gosh, Pamplemousse, not Pamplemousse, Hippocampus. That was what, that was the, it's like an indie rock thing. And it was like, hey, we know that you don't sound anything like that, but could you? And it's like, immediately you're making all these compromises. Like, oh, this is so icky. And then you don't get it. And then you feel like a prostitute. You're like, I sold myself for this thing that, and I feel so empty inside. It's just a weird spot to be in, you know?
Right. I've heard it described too, like if you ever write music for somebody else, you just don't have that same fire for it because it's not for you, it's for somebody else, you're not into it as much. Like,
yeah, that's something I wish I could, I wish I was better at. Like, I wish I could be more of a business-minded musician because I have friends that do it genuinely and they freaking crush it. Like, Jack Antonoff is my hero. He's the guy from Bleachers and he was in Fun, but he does both so well. Like when he writes for Bleachers, it is weird and only Jack Antonoff could write it. But when he's writing for Taylor Swift, you would never have guessed he wrote that song. And I just wish I had that in me. I don't. I just like have such a, we're such a niche thing that I don't think it works on a like a mass appeal scale, if I'm being honest with myself. Like I think it's just, our interests are just so small that I every time I write a song that I'm like, oh wow, that could be kind of a cool thing, I kill it. I don't know what to, you know, I don't know what it is.
Dude, I don't know, man. I don't know if I agree with that. Like when I listen to your music, I mean, I love a lot of different types of music, but I definitely kind of fall into the more like melancholy, indie rock, singer-songwriter, blah, blah, blah. But when I listen to your stuff, I'm hearing, this is me going through my adolescence, my early 20s. I am cautiously optimistic, and this is my tale. You know, this is the story that I'm telling you through these different events that have happened to me. And frankly, I don't know what's more mass appealing than that. Like, that's every kid who has his head in the clouds, which is a lot of us, a lot of the people that probably listen to your music, and one of the reasons that we connect with it.
I am definitely like painfully optimistic. That is 100% true.
Yeah.
Delusion is my biggest asset. Positive delusion. But I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. I think what it is, you know, every time I listen to a famous person, for some reason, this is always the number. I can name you the people that have said this is the number, but they say you shouldn't question your career in entertainment unless you've been doing it for 10 years. Like your career might as well not even start until 10 years in. Some people like, you know, get a lucky break, but they don't count. It's 10 years is the number. Like Pam Beasley from The Office, she was in LA.
I'm familiar.
Yeah. LA for 10 years, never got a job ever. And then walks in, first job is The Office. And, and she said like, not commercials, not like nothing, 10 years. But if you've been doing it, we've been doing it for 6 now. And when you've been doing it for 6 years and you're still grinding as much as you're grinding, you start to tell yourself, oh, it's because you're a niche thing. Oh, it's because like you don't do this thing that people want. And you start making up these, like, you start justifying where you're at and you lose sight of you do a bad job of describing yourself. So I don't know, maybe we're not niche, maybe we are, but if we were, I'd be fine with that, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. And it also, it's, you're talking to two musicians, right? So like we probably by default listen to some quote-unquote niche music.
Sure.
And so like when I hear you say niche, I think I couldn't bring my family and my super snobby friend with me to listen to this because two or three of those people would be like, I don't know, man, it's not really my bag. But then I go to your shows and I see a demographic that, yes, is maybe very Christian, but that's not a prerequisite to enjoy your music by any stretch of the imagination. That has more to do with the communities that you've built that I've been, you know, adjacent to.
Sure.
And so for me, that's why I'm like, no, I could grab three of my friends who are music snobs and then two friends that just enjoy having a good time and we could go and listen to your show and be into it. And so that's why I think you're, You may be mildly niche, but you're definitely not super niche. I mean,
no, I think that's a nice thing to say. I think.
By definition, he can't be, because my entire family and then some has came to watch him play.
That's true.
He met my mom. My dad. That
was
my sister,
that was a very sweet
cousins.
Moment. That was a very sweet time.
Oh my god!
Yeah. Yeah, when he played in Claremore, my whole family. Yep.
I still can't believe he played in Claremore.
I think that's your family crazy. Were the only ones there.
That's true.
Oh,
that
no.
That's the part about the industry that is so funny to me, is that people think that when you go on tour that people are just going to be there. But it's just not the case. No. Like, I didn't even know Claremore was a city. I don't know why I thought people would be there. Like, I learned Claremore existed as I was pulling into it, and then had the audacity to be upset it wasn't packed, you know? So.
Well, you got one family.
Yeah, so that's it. That's all go. We need, man.
That's all right. We need is that's one right. family. Dude, I have a story real quick. So, I didn't know if I was going to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. So, I was in Meridian, Mississippi today, and my band's playing there, which, Jeremiah, I hope you're laughing right now. I don't know what we're doing. I was like, yeah, why not? Let's play this place called the Brew House. Like, it's a bar. It looks fun. We'll do it. And I don't know how much experience you have with Meridian, but my gut tells me that you know enough to appreciate the story.
I'm very anxious right now.
Yeah, so I... Dude, so I print off posters. I'm doing like kind of a little bit of an internet campaign to try to like find out if there's any people with a pulse that are going to potentially maybe check out the show accidentally.
Sure.
Right. So I go to the first coffee shop. They're like super stoked I'm in there. They're ready. They're like, yeah, we'd love to. Yeah, we'll check it out. That's great. Blah, blah, blah. They put the poster up. I go down the road to another coffee shop and I walk in. And I'm like, hey, I'm David. I'm in a band from Hattiesburg. We're playing Meridian for the first time. Do you think it'd be cool if I put this poster up? And she looks at it and she's like, where are y'all playing? I was like, oh, we're playing at the Brick House. And she said, oh, no.
Oh.
And I said, oh, okay. What's the problem? She was like, oh, they serve alcohol, so we can't let you do that. And I said, okay, have a good day. And she said, you too. And I walked out. And and that was the of the many years that I've played music and tried to get people to go to my silly shows, that was the most unique experience I've ever had in a coffee shop, where apparently there was some sort of, I guess, religious undertones. I didn't catch the vibe, though. I didn't see, you know, freaking white Jesus or anything. So,
well,
I missed that.
I can't imagine being in Meridian, Mississippi, and saying I went to another coffee shop. Like,
dude, they're about to have like four or five. Man, they're trying to move up. Their PJs is going in there right now.
Yeah, that's wild, man. Yeah, it is interesting trying to have a music career in the Bible Belt. That is a very unique situation. Like, I like whenever you you said the thing about our fan base is like majority Christian, because you've only seen us in the Bible Belt where everyone is majority Christian.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, everyone in that room is like, we were all raised with a church on every single corner. That's what it's like being in the Bible Belt for sure. Yeah, sorry about that. That beer policy, man. How did the show go?
Oh, we haven't played yet. Actually, I was putting posters up today, so I'll have to let you know.
Oh, I thought you. Okay, I thought you said that we.
Yeah,
were
it's
there.
Coming.
Okay.
Coming. Yeah, coming November 22nd. So,
cool. That's awesome.
We'll see how it goes. I'm excited.
No, that's sweet.
Meridian's a really interesting town, dude.
Have you listened to Culpable yet?
Yes, listen to the whole thing.
And yikes.
Yes.
That's brutal.
Yeah.
Aaron and I,
it is brutal.
We got stuck on the interstate and someone posted about it and we binged the entire thing in the traffic jam on the interstate. Like, we were in, it took us, what was supposed to be a 6-hour drive took 12, and we gobbled that thing up. Like, we ate it all up. Man, it's really tough. And it's also weird because
that's Culpable podcast to our listeners.
Yes,
y'all should check it
it's
out.
It's a story that takes place in Meridian, Mississippi, and it is the most Meridian, Mississippi thing I've ever listened to, I think.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Yeah, they probably went to this coffee shop.
Yeah. So.
Now I got to listen to this.
Oh, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah,
man.
Dude, you got to check it out. Brad, I know you wanted to talk to him a little bit about maybe some of his songs and his songwriting.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, one of the things that you definitely do at the shows that I've been able to be at is you do a really good job of pretty much setting the scene of the song. It seems, if not every song, you know, a lot of them, you tend to, and that's probably, you know, when you say about the interaction with the crowd, I know that definitely gets interaction going. But I love hearing the stories of the different songs. I'm trying to think right off the bat, what was one I definitely wanted to ask about? I mean, I can always start with, I mean, I know it was the first song you guys did, and it was kind of the song that, I mean, I think.
Brad, did you lose your virginity to this song, be honest?
I might have.
Okay, that's awesome. Great.
I mean, I'd only been married a few years, but still, whatever.
Way to ruin my fantasy.
Be true. That could have been a very boring first 5 years of your marriage, you know?
Oh, gosh.
That would have been sad. But no, so the song Happy Now, I was kind of curious, when you write, are you a lot of autobiographical, or do you do a lot of stories?
So story...
Similar to like that one.
So I feel like you're asking me two different questions. One, like... zoomed in on Happy Now, one zoomed out on the bigger picture. So I'll answer Happy Now.
Yeah, that was a terrible question.
I have to give myself guidelines because I'll go off on all kinds of tangents. So I'll just say Happy Now is probably the song I'm most thankful for, because it is the first song that I ever wrote that someone said, hey, this has value. Because when you write songs, like when you see a band and they don't have that song, it's just like a collection of songs and this is how they sound. And it's like, yeah, cool. I sing me one of their songs. Oh, no, I can't. But that was the first song that people got stuck in their heads. And to be more vulnerable with you, it is the first song that I ever wrote that my mom liked. And my parents were big influencers in me going into this, and it was the first song that I ever wrote that got her to stop saying, hey, maybe you should consider something else. And Happy Now was the song that made her go, hey, you should pursue this. This is a big deal that you have this song. And it was extremely autobiographical. It's about my high school sweetheart. And whenever I was 16, I thought I was going to marry her. And I'm very thankful that I was wrong. Otherwise, that song wouldn't exist and none of this would, because I wouldn't have met Aaron. And that's where the story really begins. But at the time, I didn't know I was writing the song until it happened. It's one of those moments where, as a creative person, you sit down and flow comes out like an avalanche. And I sat down. I was legitimately like, I think I was waiting to go out with friends, and I was like, Matt, I've got like 10 minutes. I guess I'll just like play guitar. And I sat down, and Happy Now came out in one sitting. Like there was no,
that's so cool.
There was nothing else. That song didn't exist. And in 5 minutes it was done. And I'm trying in this current, cause we just finished making a record and I'm starting to write another record, and I'm trying to get back to Happy Now, because Happy Now I wrote because I didn't care what Happy Now was going to sound like. And every song I've written since then, I've been worried about what it's going to sound like, and it gets in the way. So Happy Now is autobiographical by accident, because I love stories. Josh Ritter is one of my heroes. Paul Simon's my hero. Like I love fiction and songwriting, because fiction, just because it's fiction doesn't mean it's not true. You know, it just means that it's not fact. And I love good storytelling. Like when you listen to The Temptation of Adam by Josh Ritter, there isn't a better song. Like it is perfect in every way. And so I do love telling those stories. But zoomed out, Happy Now, I'm realizing that the whole point of writing songs, and the whole reason we all got into this, is because it was fun. And the second you tarnish that by getting in your head, you write bad songs. And I'm trying to recalibrate to be a little kid again, pick up my guitar and just see what comes out of it, and not like, oh, maybe this could get into a commercial, maybe this could, like, just for the love of God, just write, because it's the only thing that makes you happy. And when you write when you write songs for bad reasons, it makes you hate yourself. So don't do that anymore. And that's where I'm at. Mm-hmm. And happy now kind of is the anchor of all those things, I think.
A thing that I've noticed with some of the singer-songwriters I've played with in the past is that they can kind of, they go through seasons where they're just like, oh my God, if I hear that song again that I wrote that one time that I love, but I have to play every time because everybody knows it, I'm going to freak out.
Yeah.
How have you managed those feelings? Because I'm assuming you're not immune to that.
I'm not immune to that at all. Erin would be quick to tell you that she doesn't like playing that song and hasn't for a really long time. And she has really good reason, because it's about another woman. And it is, it's like one of the iconic parts of the song is the violin part, and she doesn't like the violin part. So like there, she's got two big reasons to not like the song. I do go through seasons where after a show, you know, we go out and we meet the people that are at the show, and most of the time for a season, it was before, like some songs have kind of like replaced this, but at the time when our first record came out, it was the only remotely singable song on that record. Like it is this, that song is the hit on that record. And I don't say hit like we charted or whatever. I say hit like it's the one that like speaks to people on that record. Mm-hmm. So after every show during that record, people would come up and be like, oh my God, Happy Now, Happy Now, Happy Now. And I'd be like, we just played you 15 other songs. Like, can you talk about any of them? And then you realize that, like, dude, you are playing music in front of people, shut up and just take it as a compliment. And when I got out of my own way and just realized, like, dude, it's a freaking miracle that you've made it to almost 30 playing music for a living. Like, if they just want to talk about Happy Now, tell them the whole story. They deserve it. They showed up. Like, they got a sitter. Like, give them what they want, because if it wasn't for them, you wouldn't be able to do this. So I do go through seasons of Happy Now, and right now I'm really thankful for it. And it is the song that I play in my free time the least. Like I will pick up my guitar and I will play Circles, and I will play Even If It Kills Me, and I'll sing it and I'll mean every word of it. But I will never just be like, you know what, I'm gonna bust out Happy Now just for funsies. I never do that. Because every time, I'm a visual person, and one of the reasons I love stories is because it's really hard for me to sing Circles live because I cry in it. Like it's like a projector in the audience, and I watch it all go down. When I get to the line, we don't always miss you, darling, but we all have our days. Like, I think about it. I think about like what got me to write that song. It happens with every song. I think about how the song came out, and it's just, it's a part of my history. That song is anchored in my life, and I'm grateful for it.
So do you have one that is your favorite to do?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's just as seasonal as Happy Now. So, but like every songwriter, it's on the new album. So, because like we all love playing the new stuff. But I would say right now my favorite song to play is My Baby Jimmy and Me, because My Baby Jimmy and Me is a song that I've always wanted to write, because Paul Simon is my hero. And whenever we released it, a lot of people said, you know, that sounds like Paul Simon. I'm like, not nearly as much as I wanted it to. Like, I tried way harder for it to sound like Paul Simon. But I love that song, because that song is actually really, really depressing if you knew the whole story, because it is a song that I wrote to reconcile a friendship ending in a very dramatic way. And that song brought me and Jimmy back together. That song is really fun to sing. And that song to me, it's just like Happy Now. It is a chapter in my life that I get to remember every night, and I get to see it happen every night. And that's really great for me. I also, Old Emotions, because I love telling the story about the time that Kyle got punched in the face. That's a really fun time. And Kyle actually, the guy, so if you're listening to this and you don't know the song I'm talking about, there's a line in one of our songs called Old Emotions. It's about going back to my hometown. And this one night, Kyle got punched in the face, at a weird high school gathering. And Kyle actually found the song after it being out for like 3 years or whatever. And he DM'd me, and it was the first time I'd talked to him since high school. And he said, "Hey man, someone sent me this. Is this me?" And it was a really cool moment for me. I was like, yeah, every night I get to picture you getting punched in the face by Bradford. Like every night. And I just love that. I love those memories, man.
That's funny. Dude, and you talked a little bit about you love telling a story, not only with your music, but with your music videos. And that's the music video, right, where y'all are in, y'all did in Laurel, in the theater.
Yeah, so that's Trimble that we did that one. So, Happy
Trimble.
Now,
okay.
We did the clown one, and I learned really quick that adults are actually really afraid of clowns. And then Trimble we did in the Laurel Little Theater.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So Trimble is another song I'm super thankful for because it is a song.
It's a great tune, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate you saying that. It's a song that I when I sent it to the producer, so the first album we made it with Sam Kassir, who was my hero at the time. Like, he produced all the Josh Ritter records, David Ramirez. Like, he was the guy. And I legitimately told him when I sent him that song, hey, I just wanted to send you even the bad ones. That's what I said to him. And he called me and he was like, you sent me Trimble. Like, you don't think Trimble's bad, right? And I'm like, no, it's like weird. I don't know. And then whenever we'd start letting people listen to it, like the people on the team that are helping us like get it off the ground, they kept coming back to Trimble. And Trimble is not a sing-along song. It is a very wordy, like picturesque, like it's a very strange, melancholy song. And whenever I met this guy named Grayson Welch, and he directs music videos, he's like a wunderkind. When we met him, he couldn't even drink. And he said, we worked together on Happy Now, and it was a really great time. And then they were like, well, what if we did another one? And he even said, he's like, dude, Trimble's a great song. Let's do Trimble. And I don't take myself seriously. And I had this idea of what if we convinced everyone that this green jacket that I wear gets stolen. I wore it in the album art. I wore it all the time. I had this green jacket that I got from being Daddy Warbucks. And I had it all throughout high school. And I was like, what if someone, we post online that it gets stolen. And then the music video, it turns out it wasn't stolen. A magician took it. And that was the pitch that I made. And Grayson said, okay, well, let's talk about it, I guess. I mean, it's your money, you know, like if you want to do it. And that silly Wes Anderson inspired music video came out of a very serious song about a compulsive liar in my life, which is really weird.
Yeah, that was a super cool video, man. Freaking legit. I love it when musicians also take something from the, I don't know, like the zeitgeist or the whatever, something that's shared. It's shared with a small group of people. Like, for instance, Wes Anderson films.
Yeah.
Like, that is something that people are either going to get or they're not going to get. And then to take that and adapt that to some of your music, like, you get to, it's almost like you're living through the spirit of some of your biggest heroes.
Oh, that's exactly right.
That make art, that write, that direct. I don't know, man. That's
Aaron's made this because I get insecure sometimes, or I get insecure all the time. But I will think, like, I don't know. Sometimes whenever I get down on my luck, I think I need to just like go and like be a stand up comedian. And she says the only reason they're laughing is because they weren't expecting comedy. And I think a lot of the times our videos work because when you watch a music video, air quotes for the people listening, you're not expecting it to be good. You're expecting it to just be like the visual version of the song. And for us, it's a really great way to find a gap in the armor to the listener and be like, hey, you weren't expecting this. And it kind of like catches you off guard and you like, you feel it in a different way and you have genuine memories to that. Like, I can't remember. This is legit. I can't remember the last show we've had where someone didn't ask me, hey, where's your green jacket? And it all started with stupid music video idea that I was mostly kidding when I pitched it. And then the next one you get and you're like, what do we do next? And it's like, I want to do them bigger and bigger. We're planning the next one now. And the next one is the silliest concept, but we're getting better at what we want. Like, because when Trimble, where we're at in our career, Trimble really worked and it made us go, okay, we need to take this a little bit more seriously because we have when we did that for Grayson, like we did that with Grayson, Grayson's like, hey, listen, you're going to be my passion project. When you want to do these, if you just like help me not go in the hole, we'll keep making these. And every time we make them, it's the thing that we get known for. And it all started just because we were having fun doing it. It's one of the most fun parts about doing this is making the videos. We're filming the next one in December, and I go to sleep every night smiling, thinking about it.
Yeah. That's a lot of smiling, man. Yeah. I usually don't smile before I go to sleep. Maybe I should start doing that.
I have like a baby snicker. Like it's like Aaron always calls me that. She's like, why are you snickering right now? And I'm like, because I'm just thinking about it. It's fine. It's no big deal.
I'm just thinking about this sweet video we're going to make, man. Just get off me. What are you talking about? Yeah. Get off me.
Stop bringing it up. You're making it weird.
Stop it.
We do a really good Aaron impression.
I'm so sorry, Aaron. I'm so sorry. So you're excited about this music video. What would you want to tell our freaking listeners about? Like, besides your records, I mean, I make the joke, I probably said this to Brad before, but it's like when I go to a show, I buy a t-shirt because that's where they make their money. But what are you stoked about?
I'm stoked about, for the first time since we've been doing this, it doesn't feel newsworthy that we're doing it. Like, it doesn't feel like, oh my gosh, did you tell so-and-so that we have a show coming up? It's like, I mean, they're going to come or they're not. You know, we've been doing this long enough now to know that if they don't come, we'll still keep going. That's something that I really admire, because I mean it whenever I say I never want this to, like, I never signed up for this to be the most famous in the world. I signed up to do this because I want to live in this dream as long as it'll like float above my head. And it's cool. Like, our biggest struggle right now, we just got a dog and she's sleeping over here. Her name's Noodles. And our biggest struggle right now is figuring out how to fit our lifestyle with her. And it's been really cool for me to go to like shove my insecurities and my needs and my things out of the way and go, hey, we got to take this dog with us. Like, how do we fit her into this whole thing? And I know that sounds silly if you're not a dog person, but it's really great to like get that responsibility. And it's really strange because like Aaron and I have this game where like we try not to use the air conditioner in the house as much as we can. And because we live in an old apartment and the air is like, it does a big number to our power bill. But it was really cold. We had a cold snap and Noodles was shivering and we were like, oh my gosh, we have to turn the heat on. And we turned it on because we saw that the dog was cold. And because we saw the dog was cold, we treated ourselves better. You know, like, we wouldn't treat ourselves the way we, you know, it's just wild, man. So that's something I'm really excited about. We're thinking about changing the way we travel and doing it RV style, which would be, I would say that's the thing I'm most excited about right now. Just the idea of traveling more sustainably, like being more of a trio, me, her, and Noodles, and just like having that, I feel like we're entering in a new chapter of doing this, which I think is going to be really great.
That's freaking cool. Brad, what else is on your mind, man?
I'm just excited for when is the new record? When are you hoping it's
so done? Joymonger is done. All we got to do now is we got to get it back from the vinyl pressing plant and all that other stuff. We've done like the photos for it and all that other stuff, but so the next step for us is to get the videos, to get the like the market, you know, like you when you release an album, you have to like we're here, it's a new album, like we all have different haircuts and I don't, but Aaron will, and you know, like it's just you start that cycle. And for us, because the videos have been so much fun in the past, we will start every album cycle with one of these videos. And the next step is to film the video, get it. We're shooting it on 16 millimeter film, which is something that I've always wanted to do. That's like really exciting to me. And that hopefully that will be the first thing that we release. My goal is to release it on my 30th birthday, but I don't think that that's realistic because that, like, that is me being so self-serving. But, the goal is to have the whole record out by spring, like the whole thing. And then we'll do singles and tour and that kind of stuff. We're booking shows in March right now and just playing all that stuff. Like, we're always on tour a little bit, but it'll like ramp up around, it'll ramp up around spring is whenever it's like in full force probably. But the album's called Joymonger, and we, you know, we made some of it in our apartment. We made some of it in Nashville, and it was just songs that I really, you know, that I really believe in, and that songs that we've really been enjoying playing live.
Well, Jeremiah, thank you so much for taking some time out of your week, taking some time to chat with us.
Yeah, this was fun. I like you guys. This was painless. I appreciate you guys letting me come on.
Oh man, you can come on whenever
you want. That's
so
kind of
you. You can be the next member if you want.
Can there be two bald guys in one podcast? Is that a thing?
I think so, man. But then we'd have to change our cover, and it would have to be like cartoon doodles of all of us. And people would be like, which one's Brad? Which one's Jeremiah? I don't know.
What?
And then
I remember, so the teacher that I talked about, let's book in this with bald. So
perfect.
Let's book in this podcast. So I remember that guy that taught me about Coochie Cream. He was extremely inappropriate, but he came up to me in the cafeteria one day, and I had been shaving my head at this point, and he put his head up against my head. We were touching bald heads, and he said, look at us, just a couple of boobs. Sometimes I think about that, and it makes me laugh, and there's no context for it. It's just, that just tickles me to no end.
Dude.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate you
having
me.
I can't wait to Google, No, don't do that, Jeremiah. Real quick, let me Google Coochie Cream. I want a 2-day ship this thing.
It may still be.
No, there. I know it is.
Yeah. There is like a very harsh pink one, and then I vaguely remember like a very ugly blue one. Very, very tacky. Are you looking
everybody,
it up?
You're welcome. Oh yeah, no. I'm seriously. I can't wait to show my wife.
No, that's great.
She's gonna be like, "What do you want to do with that?" I'm going to shave my head.
Just leave it open ended for a while.
Absolutely.
Say head. Yeah. Well, I guess we'd be remiss if we didn't let you tell everybody where they can find you.
Yeah. So we're all over the internet.
Interwebs.
Yeah, so our website is ojeremiah.com, but if you go to, we're on Instagram, it's o_jeremiah, and then Facebook and all that other stuff. But Spotify is where we send most people, because Spotify is kind of the thing now. And, you know, if you come see us a show, that's how you mean the most to us. If you come and you meet us and you, like, come pet our dog, because she's going to be making appearances at some point.
And can they order?
Come rub his head.
Yeah, that's it.
Yes, come rub his head. Absolutely. Can you order? Do y'all do merchandise online?
We do
or
merch
online. Like that, or is it?
We do merch online.
Okay.
And we do.
Sweet.
What else do we do? Yeah, we do merch online. If you want to just like reach out, you can talk to us. We're highly reachable, to say the least.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, y'all buy some of their stuff, man. Check it out.
Yeah.
All right.
Awesome. Jeremiah,
well, thanks,
thank you.
Dude.
Okay. Yeah. Love you. Mean it.
Peace.
I danced upon your ceiling, babe, like Elvis dangling from the stars. Your king that sparked with every shake. No Memphis sun could save you from the dark. What's it gonna take to entertain?
So that is our episode with O. Jeremiah. I hope that you really enjoyed it. I'm telling you, if you haven't already looked up their music, you need to do it. It's a treat. It's really good music, and they're just great people on top of that. So go out and support them. Buy their record. Go to their shows when they come to a town near you, and just enjoy the goodness that is O. Jeremiah. Guys, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for listening to our podcast. We know that you have 8 million choices in podcasts, and the fact that you chose to listen to us for an hour, hour and 15 minutes out of your day is just an honor that we can never thank you enough for. We're already in the planning stages of next season, and I'm telling you guys, next season is going to be epic for us. We're going to hit 100 episodes, which is just crazy to even think about. But on top of that, we are coming up with some content that I think you are really going to enjoy. We're going to be looking at some historical events, some from Oklahoma, some from not. We're going to be coming up with different topics that we can discuss, bring on different guests, maybe even bigger guests than we've brought on to this point. And we brought on some pretty good guests at this point. But with that being said, if you want to get a hold of us, you're more than welcome to. We welcome that. There are many different ways for you to do that. You can get a hold of us on Facebook, on Twitter. We're now on Instagram. We also have a Patreon, which we are starting to develop content for Patreon specifically. If you listened a few episodes back to the conversation that James has with his older brother, Kyle, we're going to start posting some of those conversations for you, unedited, just how they come out, just making sure that the levels are good. That's all the editing we're going to do to them. And I know that you're going to love that. On top of that, we're going to be sharing more of ourselves with you, whether that be through some type of video or just any other way that we can get content out to you. We are wanting to connect with you. Please go and rate us on iTunes. So leave us a review if you feel inclined. But thank you again for supporting us and being there for us by listening to us. We love bringing this to you, and we can't wait to bring you more in the future. Our next episode is going to be with James Price, where we talk to him about some of his music and how he came up with those songs, what headspace he was in, all of that. So you're not going to want to miss that. And after James, we are going to be talking to Zach Ramey of the infamous band Distractions of Less, which was the high school band that David and I was in high school. We play their music, or we play our music quite a bit on here, but we're going to get to talk to the third member of that band to close this season out. So with that being said, I hope you have a great week, and we'll see you in a couple weeks talking to James Price. On behalf of David Meggs and James Eisenhower, I'm Brad Stair, and everything is okay, people.
I woke up in an El Camino, 6 shoes on the leather seat. He's on the wheel, she's out the window. That's my baby, Jimmy and me. That's my baby, Jimmy and me. New York City hangs above us, big apple from the forbidden tree. She's on my arm, he's cussing drivers. We're wide awake in the American dream. That's my baby, Jimmy and me. Life ain't that funny, we'll just laugh at anything. Try to keep this good feeling alive. Our engine burning keeps the world turning. Can we keep this good feeling alive? Ooh, ooh. Mardi Gras dress down the aisle coming after me. The preacher asked, you know I said yes. I'm wide awake in my own dream. Me and my baby, we got married.
I don't see Jimmy all that often. I know he's out there in the street, pounding his chest, calling out to us. Time plays silly tricks on me. That's my baby, Jimmy and me. That's my baby, Jimmy and me. That's my baby, Jimmy and me. Life ain't that funny. We'll just laugh at anything to try to keep them from seeing us cry. I'm